Good morning. Please be seated. Our next case is 2022-0707 in the matter of the State of Ohio versus Glenn Stalder. On behalf of the appellant, Mr. Sabo. Good morning.
Morning, Your Honor. Madam Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court, my name is Joseph Sabo, counsel for appellant, State of Ohio. I would respectfully request 2 minutes be reserved for rebuttal. Thank you. There are two issues currently before the court in this matter. The first issue concerns the establishment of a prima facie case of purposeful discrimination during jury selection. As previously stated by this court in its opinion in State versus Brooks, parties may exercise a peremptory challenge for any reason without inquiry and without a court's control, so long as the challenge is not for the purpose of excluding a juror on account of a protected class, such as race or gender.
Counsel, do you concede that the trial court judge in this particular case, from the reading of the transcript, wasn't aware that a Batson challenge could be made according to gender?
Yes, Your Honor. So I would agree that the trial court did incorrectly state the law as so. In Batson versus Kentucky, the United States Supreme Court established that prior to a party having to provide a reason for exercising a peremptory challenge and prior to the trial court having to decide on the ultimate issue of purposeful discrimination, it's the burden of the objecting party, here the appellee, to establish a prima facie case through facts and other relevant circumstances sufficient to raise an inference of purposeful discrimination against jurors on the basis of race. That was then extended in the other Supreme Court case, JEB versus Alabama, to include gender. So you have both race and gender.
And the trial court judge didn't seem to be aware of that fact.
That is correct, Your Honor.
But is that exactly accurate? I thought I recall reading where the trial court just didn't think it specifically applied to gender with a specific ethnicity, i.e., in this case, white males. So in other words, it could apply to gender, but specifically not to white males.
That is correct. That was in the opinion, the record that he did state that that in this matter with the jurors, juror 1296 and juror 1297, both being based on the record, white males, that he did not feel that Batson applied.
So is it clear there whether it was his misunderstanding of the gender applying or ethnicity?
I would argue in that particular circumstance that he felt that that white males did not apply under Batson.
But again, gender and or ethnicity? So in other words, would he have done the analysis if the jurors were white females or black males?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. It was a situation where the trial court did misstate the law and not extending to understand that based on the statements that were made at the trial court level that Batson and JEB versus Alabama does include gender. However, my argument today is that what the trial court did was summarily reject the objection by appellee, and that was a correct decision based on what was provided by appellee in support of its objection to the peremptory challenge by the state.
What more would the objecting party have had to articulate to make that?
So as reflected by an opinion in this court in State versus Bryan, the burden of proving intentional discrimination belongs to the objecting party. So that is clear. In this case, the Fifth District Court of Appeals found that appellee had established a prima facie case of purposeful discrimination on the basis of gender on jurors 1296 and 1297, yet none of the there was actually nothing that was stated by appellee during the objection to support. And there's a number of cases that were cited in appellant's merit brief that point to facts and other relevant circumstances in the past that have aided in making a finding of a prima facie case of purposeful discrimination on the basis of race and gender.
Well, in the context of this personal, in this case, you had a male defendant accused of sex crime. The makeup of the jury with pool was primarily female, and the first peremptory strike, presumably everybody passed for cause, the first peremptory strike is against a male. Isn't that enough to cause Batson to follow its mandated course and have the state provide a gender-neutral reason?
Your Honor, I would argue no. I would argue that does not meet the level necessary to establish an inference of purposeful discrimination by the party exercising the peremptory challenge. The facts and circumstances, relevant circumstances that are mentioned in other cases in appellant's merit brief, they include things such as statements and questions made by appellant or responses by prospective jurors during voir dire examination. They include a broader history of discriminatory practices that may occur outside of that case, a pattern of strikes in that particular case.
Does there have to be a pattern? Can they raise it on the first one?
No, and that is something that was actually consistent with this court, a decision in State versus White, that a pattern of strikes is not a prerequisite to finding a prima facie case, but that it certainly may be a factor to be considered in the context of all the facts and circumstances. And in this matter, there was no pattern of strikes. In addition, the other thing that courts have considered, bare statistics. And what bare statistics mean is that the final composition or makeup of the jury as a result of the peremptory strikes support an inference of purposeful discrimination. A best example of that would be the Supreme Court case JEB versus Alabama.
Yes. Counsel, I hear you, but a more practical question.
Yes.
If we agree with you in reverse, we have to send it back for a Batson hearing, and the jury pool isn't the same.
So I would argue that a prima facie case was never even established in this matter. Therefore, the trial court's overruling the objection was appropriate because there was nothing provided in the objection to even support.
So if we reverse, there is no remand in your view?
Correct. And then the conviction would be upheld in regards to that issue. And as I've already said, a pattern of strikes is not necessary, but here there was no pattern of strikes. There was no statements. In the objection made by appellee, there was no reference to any statements made by the appellant, no responses by the jurors to indicate that the appellant was targeting jurors on the basis of gender, and there was no history mentioned of discriminatory practices, and also there was no bare statistics in this case to support.
Did the judge do anything to prevent defense counsel from making a prima facie case?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe that there was a sufficient opportunity to raise anything in that objection. There was certainly, according to the record, some back and forth between the trial court and appellee, and certainly an opportunity for them to give examples of why they felt there was support for an inference of purposeful discrimination.
And the only thing defense counsel said was that he suspects that you're going to disqualify white males. There is nothing else in the record?
I would say yes. That there was nothing else. So,
and are there any cases that have found that to be enough to be a prima facie case?
I would argue, compared to the facts and circumstances in this case, no.
So what else could or would, other than showing a pattern which may not exist, what else could have been offered as a prima facie case? Could defense counsel have come in and say, you know, here's scientific studies that show men are less likely to convict other men in similar instances? I mean, what else would have need to be presented?
So I would argue that there would need to be facts and circumstances relevant to that specific case and those specific jurors or practices by that particular appellant. I mean, the concern coming in where you're bringing in outside data would be the concern that is not necessarily an inference in this case of purposeful discrimination by that particular party.
I'm sorry.
Just from the transcript,
The very first peremptory challenge was juror number 1296.
Yes.
And then at that point in time, counsel for the defendant made an objection, and he said, Your Honor, at this time, we'd ask the state to explain that challenge. We believe that they are doing it simply because he is a male and would tend to sympathize with my client. That's not enough. That's where is that deficient?
I would argue that that's insufficient because there is no, the appellee is not pointing to any particular facts or relevant circumstances to support that belief that the jurors would be, and specifically male jurors, would tend to sympathize more with the...
Okay, with the defendant. Let's switch around. Let's make it race. Let's say that the challenged juror, if the defendant were Latino and the two excluded jurors were Latino, that wouldn't be enough? If the exact same words the defense counsel says, but instead of saying male, saying that he was of Latin descent.
I would still argue that without facts and relevant circumstances to show that there was actual evidence that those particular jurors would be more sympathetic, I would argue that it would be insufficient to say that just because of the the ethnicity of that juror, that they would then automatically be more sympathetic to the defendant.
But the judge,
the challenge was directly related to the crime charged, correct?
I'm sorry.
So the challenge made was directly related to the offense charged, because this is what the defendant is charged with. These individuals, men, would be more likely to be sympathetic to this type of a crime. That was the only challenge, correct?
Yes.
There was nothing presented to demonstrate that as it relates to this kind of a crime, that there is some correlation based on gender.
I would agree that there was nothing raised to indicate that in that particular circumstance that those jurors, male jurors specifically, would be more sympathetic to the defendant given the allegations in that offense. And that would be consistent, what I'm arguing here today would be consistent with a very recent opinion by this court in State versus McAlpin, where it was this court's opinion that speculation falls far short of establishing discrimination that would support an equal protection challenge. That's what's happening, is the appellee is making speculations and arguing beliefs without providing statements, remarks, or other relevant circumstances to support purposeful discrimination.
So the charge was one count of sexual imposition.
Correct.
And the trial judge did not even know, I mean, the trial judge didn't comprehend the Batson challenge, and finally Mr. Sanderson had to tell him gender is a protected class. Do we have any concerns about that?
So, and in my brief, I did acknowledge that there was a misstatement of the law. Yes, that Batson has been extended to include gender. The issue here, though, is that the burden still is on the objecting party to raise a prima facie case of purposeful discrimination, such that would raise an inference.
So, what would have to happen? If we agree with you, do we have to say there has to be first some questioning? Of the particular juror to elicit some type of response to make that case?
And it's not just a statement or response by a particular juror, just some type of facts or relevant circumstances from that case, whether, and again, like with JEB versus Alabama, where you had 9 out of the 10 peremptory challenges exercised on male jurors, and as a result, you had a jury pool, a final jury panel that consisted of nothing but female jurors. So there's plenty of other ways that a prima facie case can be established.
Well, in this case, the record reflects the majority of jury members were female, right? And the defendant's a male, and he's charged with attacking a female.
But I would argue still that the burden then is also proving that the peremptory challenge is purposeful discrimination by the party that's exercising it.
Right. So if he raised it correctly, and if the judge understood the law correctly, then you would just simply say, that's not why I'm picking him. I'm picking him because I don't like the reaction he had during some of the jury's instructions, which would be completely gender neutral, as you did in the second juror, right? Or this?
Yes. My understanding is when the trial court asked for a response, it was in direct relation to the objection and the allegations that were made by Apelli, and it was not believed at that time that the response that was being asked for was an explanation for excusing that juror. And until a prima facie case is established, it is not required that there be an explanation for that peremptory challenge.
What about the wrong application of the law, or the misstatement of the law?
And again, I would say that would be an issue if a prima facie case had been established. But here, because there was nothing in support of that objection, then the only option for the trial court was to overrule that objection because nothing was provided to support that claim.
So you're saying right result, wrong reason.
Yes. I see that. I've run out of time now. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Sanderson, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court, Andrew Sanderson on behalf of Glenn Stalder. And I apologize up front. I'll probably refer to Mr. Stalder as the appellant at some point in time. It is unusual for me to be the appellee. So I apologize in advance if I have that slip of the tongue.
Well, counsel, let me just ask you this question right off the bat. Why wasn't the trial court, what happened at the trial court, the right decision, even if for the wrong reasons?
Your Honor, we maintain that the Fifth District is the right decision for the right reasons. And the government has conceded that the trial court was completely incorrect in its analysis, its application of law, its reasoning, but still wants to have the Fifth District overturned. That's exactly what the Fifth District said. The Fifth District said the trial court was incorrect for A, B, and C. We maintain that what should have happened here is we should have been able to get into those things. The government keeps wanting to say...
Get into those things. I mean, so the first step is you have to make a prima facie case. I mean, the judge didn't stop you from saying anything, did he?
I think he did.
The judge said some things that were obviously wrong about the law, but as I look at this transcript, he gave you the opportunity to... Or I don't know if you were counsel or not, but he gave counsel chance to say whatever counsel wanted, right?
I was counsel, and I don't believe so. Your Honor, I'm going
to... point to me where you got cut off, then.
Well, it's not cut off, Your Honor, but I can't keep belaboring a point. Once a judge rules against me and says that I don't see this as an applicable area to even raise this issue, I'm done.
Well, no, that's generally... You're not generally. You can say, Judge, I didn't make a proffer for the record. That happens all the time, right?
I did. I proffered into the record that my client was a male. That peremptory challenge from the government number one was as to a male. The peremptory challenge number two from the government was as to a male.
Is that enough under our case law?
I believe that once the judge then tells me that I don't get to raise that issue again, which is what the trial court said here, and I'll use the trial court's language, period, I think I'm done at that point.
Well, but the question, though, is, you know, did you put on that prima facie case clearly if you put on a prima facie case, then the judge made a mistake, and that's clear, but... it's not clear to me that you articulated enough to even start the process, right? I mean, this is not a new issue. In State v. Johnson, we said that to establish a prima facie case, you must demonstrate that members of a cognizable group were peremptorily challenged. Okay, we've done that. And two, that the facts in any other relevant circumstance raise an inference that the prosecutor used the peremptory challenges to exclude jurors on account of their gender. Now, did you point to any of those facts? Or are there any facts in the record that would show that?
Yes.
What?
The statement of the prosecutor.
What's that?
The statement of the prosecutor.
Well, that's not really a prima facie case, though, is it? I mean,
the prosecutor is describing his reasoning for what he's doing. And he describes all of the jurors as being fair, described them as fair and impartial, and that what he's seeking to do is, quote-unquote, eliminate particular jurors.
So why is that? I don't see what's wrong. I don't see what's wrong with that. There's nothing that he seeks to eliminate particular jurors based on sex.
There is when particular juror number one is of a particular gender, particular juror number two is of a particular gender, and the defendant is of a particular gender.
So you think that by itself, if someone exercises two peremptory challenges of the same gender, that by itself establishes a prima facie case?
No, Your Honor.
Same gender as the defendant?
No.
What else is here? That's my question. What else did you point to?
The statement of the prosecutor that all of the jurors that he was eliminating, demonstrated that they would be fair and impartial during voir dire.
Well, but that's a point of peremptory challenges. You're allowed to eliminate jurors who are fair and impartial, right? I mean, you just can't do so based on sex, or race. So.
And in this case, what the record demonstrates is only that they shared the same sex.
Didn't the state have another peremptory, and weren't there males left on the jury?
The state did not exercise any additional peremptories.
But they had at least one more,
yes, Your Honor.
And there were males on the jury.
There are, I believe, twice as many women on the jury, and I'm not going to assume why they stopped challenging males at that point in time. It may be that they have come to the realization that the issue of gender within that jury selection process was getting muddied. At no time did the government tell the trial court that they were incorrect in their application here. The government knew
that who was incorrect?
That the trial court was incorrect. That the trial court incorrectly was determining that
gender didn't matter.
Exactly.
Counsel, when the state made the first peremptory and struck a male from the pool, they had all been passed from cause, right?
Yes, sir.
The bulk of the pool was female, right?
Yes, sir.
So you stand up, and I'm reading from the transcript. Your Honor, I have a feeling that every one of the state's peremptory challenges is going to be a man who is a man in this case. I'm asking out of the box that they start justifying that before we go get too far along this road. And the court says, I don't know that any other men indicated any type of bias in favor of them, which isn't relevant to a peremptory. So what more do you have to do to just move to the second step?
I guess at this point, Your Honor, I don't know. Because I think what I think is clear is that, Your Honor, voir dire, as the government has pointed out, is an important part of this process. What we're trying to do is, at least in theory, pick a fair and impartial jury. And that, though, comes with some strings. And those strings are that we get, as attorneys, to challenge people off that are going to be fair and impartial, that we will concede are fair and impartial. But when those eliminations start to have a pattern, and in this case, the government can characterize it as not being a pattern, but 100% of their peremptories, and I will grant you it's only two, 100% of their peremptories shared the same gender.
Well, counsel, in follow-up with Justice Donnelly's question, at least under the Batson analysis, you must demonstrate that members are recognized under Batson as racial group, but here we know it's gender, so you did that. And then the second prong is that the facts and any other relevant circumstances raise the inference that the state used the peremptory challenges to exclude based on gender. So what was that second prong you did, or is it your assertion that the trial court stopped you after prong one and you couldn't even get to prong two?
As Justice Donnelly pointed out, what I told the trial court is that I suspected exactly what was going to happen is what happened.
Okay, but that raised the gender.
That's the second part.
No, the second part is the facts and any other relevant circumstances raise the inference that they're using the peremptory for an unlawful reason. So, but saying, I mean, maybe it seems elementary, but saying that I suspect the path we're going down is the state's going to exclude men because this is a sex crime and that men jurors are more likely to be sympathetic to my defendant, you know, in these circumstances. I mean, you just said, I suspect we're going down the path that the state's going to exclude, use their peremptories to exclude men. So that clearly brings up the first prong. But what about that second?
The fact that my client is male.
Okay.
And
did you say that? And this is a sex crime?
Yes. And that's, well, Your Honor, I'll take that back. I'm not sure that I say that. What I say is that I think that those type of jurors will be more sympathetic to my client. To use Your Honor's analogy before, if what we're talking about here are Hispanic jurors and a Hispanic defendant, if I say on the record that my client's Hispanic and that these two, 100% of the jurors excluded by the government, eliminated, to use their word, by the government, were Hispanic jurors, I think that we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Well, but in the example I give, you have a Latino defendant and two Latino jurors, and it might wipe them out completely from the jury. You have males left in this veneer. So, did you have to do a little bit more? If you're saying my client is of Latin descent and the only two jurors of Latin descent were excluded from the jury, yeah, that's probably pretty obvious. Do you have to go any further? But here, you still have members of the protected class, males, left in the jury pool. So did you have to do a little more than just say, hey, this path we're going down?
Unfortunately, Your Honor, because of the way voir dire works, couldn't do that because I have no way of predicting what the peremptories are going to be unless I bring that issue up when I do. And I can only bring it up when I do in a speculative manner. What I can say to the trial court is, look, I think we've got an issue here, and I'm going to rely on you to understand what the law is as the trial judge and make a proper determination that this is an issue that needs to be given consideration and weight. And if the very first person that they challenge on a peremptory challenge matches my client in every respect, I have an issue that I need to bring up. Now, there's no way for me to get to juror number 6 or, to use the numbers in JEB, 9 out of 10, because at that point we've already excluded the first 8. At what time have we put the thumb on the scale far enough to weigh it against my client?
And when the judge says gender, Batson doesn't apply to white males, then what happened?
I tried to explain to him that he did. And I was told by the trial court that he didn't see it that way, and his exact words were period.
Mr. Sanderson, so you exercised 4 peremptory challenges, all women.
Yes, ma'am.
State exercised 2 peremptory challenges, both men.
Yes, ma'am.
The first peremptory challenge, you brought up what you described as the Batson objection. State says you didn't make a prima facie case regardless. The second peremptory challenge from the state automatically stepped up and said, I can provide an explanation, Your Honor, and the court says, basically, well, I don't know that one is necessary, but if you wish to provide one, you may. And the state says, just in terms of his response, meaning yours, and how he, oh, the juror, and his response and how he would react in a stressful situation. So he provided some non-gender-based reason, but then the court said, all right, but regardless, juror number 1297 will be excused. So it looks to me like the Fifth District really had a problem with the court's application of the law here. Is that why you would want us to affirm?
Yes, Your Honor. Let me rephrase that. That's not why I would want you to affirm. I wouldn't want you to affirm because the trial court was wrong. That's why I would want you to affirm. This is a situation where the trial court, by all accounts, by my account, by the government's account, by the Fifth District's account, by everyone's account involved in this, the trial court did this incorrectly. They were wrong, period. to use the trial court's words again. They were just incorrect. The government is asking you to affirm a conviction where they concede that the trial court was incorrect in one of the most fundamental aspects.
Well, I think that's a slight mischaracterization. The state concedes that the trial court got the law, statement of the law, wrong. But as counsel said earlier, but he believes the decision was right based on not establishing a prima facie case, so right result, wrong reason.
But, Your Honor, let's take the trial court out of it. Let's okay. say that the trial court doesn't make the ruling erroneously, and that we're able to discuss this issue.
Okay.
And then what we have on the record is the government saying that they're going to eliminate particular jurors that they describe as fair and impartial, without giving any other basis for that. And a situation where gender of the jurors being eliminated and the defendant are identical. And it is not one half or a third. It is 100% of the jurors that they exclude.
Well, but again, and with all due respect to people who identify differently other than male or female, you're saying that the excluded gender people, gender of the two people were 100% the same as the defendant. I mean, you got generally a 50-50 split there, but there were people left in the veneer who were the same gender as the defendant.
True.
So, you know, whether and you use your peremptories to exclude people who were the gender of the victim, 100%.
Holy.
So, again, but there were women left in the jury.
And, Your Honor, I'm in a different situation.
I understand. I understand. You don't have the same burden that the state has. I get that.
And if I may, Your Honor, the difficulty here is setting aside the decision. That's where the problem lies in our estimation. What the government's asked this court to do is reverse the Fifth District and or remand it for what would be a different kind of Batson hearing.
And how do we do that?
Frankly, I have no idea. But that's what the government has encouraged this court to do. The Fifth District found, and I guess at that point, if it goes back to the trial court, and the government went so far in its reply brief to suggest pulling Judge Landenfeld out of retirement to come sit on the bench, do a Batson hearing, then after that Batson hearing, I guess it goes, if the trial court then says, yeah, I find there wasn't a violation, then it would go back to the Fifth District for an analysis of that decision. And I assume if they rule in favor of the trial court, an analysis of the other assignments of error that were raised in the Fifth District by the appellant that were rendered moot by the original decision. And then I don't know where it goes from there. But that's the difficulty here, Your Honor. And you can't take out of the equation the wrong ruling. And even if the government believes that the result and the end was correct, the defendant surely doesn't. And the defendant did a trial with 100% of the jurors being excluded by the government who shared the same gender as him in a situation where the trial court said that simply, and said incorrectly, that simply didn't matter.
And you've argued structural error here, correct?
Yes, sir.
Which we can't wipe it away with harmless error if it's structural error.
And there's a reason why the government can't and doesn't just say the word harmless error. It would seem that that's what the argument is here, that this is a harmless error. It's not the prima facie didn't get made. It's that even if the trial court knew what a Batson challenge was and applied it properly to this situation, it wouldn't have mattered because he would have ruled properly. Well, they can't say that because every authority out there says that harmless error is not applied to these type of situations. That's why the words harmless error don't appear in their brief. It's just not something that can happen. You can't have a harmless error review of this type of situation. So what we're trying to do is couch harmless error in the argument that the prima facie evidence wasn't made. And, Your Honor, I don't know what else I could do other than to say I think they're going to exclude all of these jurors when they excluded all of the jurors that they excluded that were exactly the same as my client. Thank you, Your Honors.
So let me ask just one question. So if I've got my math right, The veneer was started out with 13 males, 10 females, right?
Just the opposite.
I don't know that, Your Honor. I'll trust the court's math.
That's what the briefs say, anyway. Four females were excluded, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And two males were excluded.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so you ended up with six females and three males.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so and they had two more peremptories left. So they could have excluded. They could have excluded two more males if they wanted to.
Potentially, Your Honor.
And the only people left would have been, and they would have been replaced by females.
We don't know that, Your Honor.
We do, because there were six females made on the jury. You start out with 10. So the only people left in the veneer would have been females, I think.
Counsel, weren't there 13 females and 10 males?
Your Honor, I think the record will show what the potential panel was, but I don't think that they could have necessarily been down to definitively saying it would have been females or males that would have replaced them. That's another one of the problems here, is that the record doesn't necessarily reflect where people are in order, where they are within the panel. The jury pool, what's in the jury box is perhaps reflected, and through the roll call and things of that nature, there are some things that are demonstrated by the voir dire, but the actual questionnaires and things of that nature are not part of the record.
Okay.
Counsel, I want to go back. You saw me ask your opposing counsel a question about reversal and what happens, because they've asked for kind of two things, reverse and say there was no prima facie case and you lose, right?
Yeah, sure.
Or reverse, and they kind of intimate something about another Batson hearing of some type.
Yes, Your Honor.
If you win, your client gets a new trial.
Yes, Your Honor.
From scratch.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Is the reverse and remand for Batson hearing even possible?
In my opinion, no, Your Honor. And I tried to explain that before. I'm not sure logistically how that works. I don't believe that, first of all, the voir dire is a fluid thing, and as with all trials. I mean, even that part of voir dire is going to impact how you present your case. If you have more males on a jury or more females on a jury, you may make different arguments. You may be more aggressive with witnesses than you would be without that same makeup. It's just hard to say what the trial would look like, number one. Number two, we're going to have a different judge. We're going to have a judge who wasn't there at the time of the original arguments. When the panel was there and these questions were raised to the panel, this judge that would sit on, unless we bring Judge Landefeld out of retirement, the judge who would sit over the trial now, and the case was set to go to trial. It was remanded back down. It was reset for trial in front of Judge Ullum, and then it was stayed pending the appeal to this court. So it's there awaiting a trial with Judge Ullum, but not with Judge Landefeld. And it would be Judge Landefeld under the government's mechanism who would do this quote-unquote Batson hearing. And he would do it based on what happened, I assume, during the original trial with respect to the voir dire process, and then make a ruling based on that that would then have to be subject to review again by the Fifth District, assuming that at that point we get the standard of law and everything else correct. So I don't know how that works. And I don't know how that works and doesn't impact all the things that happened after the trial court's erroneous ruling. And we maintain that that's just an improper remedy.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Counsel, you have 18 seconds left if you want to wrap up. Mr. Sabo.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly, in regards to the remand issue, so that issue would be if this court finds that there was a prima facie case established, then the Fifth District also erred in how it remanded the case back. So they remanded it back for a new trial. It is not uncommon or unusual, as even Batson versus Kentucky, that's what they did. They remanded it back to determine the issue of purposeful discrimination.
Counsel, what more, based on the transcript, could defense counsel have done to establish a prima facie case?
They could have pointed to statements made by the jurors, statements made by the prosecutor.
Do they have to? I mean, they're looking at a pool, and it doesn't matter if males still remained on the jury, right? We have to have a unanimous jury to convict.
Correct.
All you need is one person to disagree with the rest. So, what more could they have done? If we reverse the Fifth District, aren't we incentivizing judges who read this opinion to not follow the correct law and just simply ask the state for a gender-neutral response to what was said?
I would argue that to affirm the decision would create the it would take away the burden on the objecting party to establish a prima facie case through facts and circumstances. So essentially, based on this decision out of the Fifth District, an objection solely based on the fact that the juror that is attempted to be excluded is of the same protected class as the defendant, and that the objecting party simply believes that the prosecutor is targeting that juror based on a protected class, without providing any other information, without providing any other facts or circumstances, whether it be the makeup of the jury, statements made, history of discriminatory practices. So I would argue that in this case, you ask what more could be done, Your Honor. I don't think that there was anything more that could be done, because I don't think that there was sufficient evidence to support purposeful discrimination.
Even though a pattern is not required.
Correct. But certainly, it's a factor to be considered. Just like anything, this is not a definite list. There's many reasons and many factors and circumstances that come into play. But certainly, if the court feels that a prima facie case has been established, it would not be abnormal to remand it back for the issue of determining whether there was actually, in fact, purposeful discrimination. The trial court never made that determination, never considered the reasons given by the prosecutor for why that juror 1297 was excused. So if it was remanded back and the trial court made the determination that there was purposeful discrimination, then at that point, the proper remedy would be a new trial. But if it's found that there was not purposeful discrimination, then it would be unfair and it wouldn't be proper to order a new trial when there was, in fact, no violation of equal protection. So for that, I would ask that you reverse the decision by the Fifth District. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you will receive a decision from the court.